Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Join us on Monday evenings, U.S. Eastern Time, as we explore homeopathy and facial analysis, a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brooks and Grant Bentley, homeopath and naturopath. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go!
Hi, I am Debbie Brooks, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Grant Bentley, Australian homeopath and specialist in the facial analysis method. Today is February 6, 2012, and we're continuing this journey along with Grant. And please, if you've missed any of the shows, just go to the major page for Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio and look at the archives. You can download any of them to your iTunes, to your iPod, your iPhone, or whatever phone you've got. Listen to it on your computer. You can even share them with friends to let other people know about these wonderful shows. So just jump in. We're going to be continuing learning along, and you can also send us questions, comments. If you want to learn something specific, let us know ahead of time so we can address those issues. And we're going to be talking today about the unprejudiced observer, which is a foundation for homeopathic case-taking. Everyone who wants to practice homeopathy or learn about homeopathy should know these basic points. So Grant, who is the senior lecturer of the Victorian College of Classical Homeopathy, Homeopathic Facial Analysis, HFA Research in Melbourne, Australia, is with us this evening.
Hi, Debbie. How are you?
Doing okay. I hope you've had a good start to this week. I did receive from Louise it's a poll out there on the internet for whether we're going to have alternative medicine available in medical schools. Was that what it was? I'm trying to remember what that little poll was.
Well, it was more, we don't necessarily have designated medical schools, although there are some private colleges, certainly, that teach alternative medicines here. But there are also, too, a number of university courses that range from acupuncture, naturopathy, and chiropractic in particular, and a number of other modalities such as reflexology and homeopathy that are aiming to try and get in some way, shape, or form their foot in the door into the university system here. And so that is, of course, as all things do, when it comes to alternative therapies, has caused a little bit of a backlash with the skeptics here. Of course, they made a very big fuss in England there for a while and didn't really achieve much of their aims. But of course, that doesn't stop them. So what they're doing now is that it seems that they're turning their attention to Australia. One would think they'd have better things to do with their life than just tell other people what not to do.
I agree with you. This comes from the Sydney Morning Herald, the National Times, February 4th, 2012. It's an opinion piece. Should universities teach alternative medicine? And you're able to vote in the poll, yes or no, no matter where you live, I suppose. And, of course, we need to learn everything. We shouldn't stop ourselves from learning about the world.
So. Well, there are those, and particularly with the skeptics. The ironic twist, of course, is that the skeptics are the people that you should be most skeptical of. And anybody that is trying to limit another human being's thought process should always be treated with great skepticism. And that's exactly what it is that they're trying to do. It's in the same way that the Inquisition tried to stop free thought, and the skeptics are trying to bully people into giving up their right to at least ask whatever it is that they want to ask. They're doing this under the banner of scientific rationalism, but of course that's not really the major interest. People are free to make up their own minds whether or not they want to see a homeopath or a naturopath, or they don't want to see that. What their real agenda is to wipe things like this off the face of the earth simply because it just doesn't agree with the opinions they hold. So I find it very ironic, as a matter of fact, that science, who historically was suppressed traditionally by the church, and the church was holding it back because it wouldn't allow any other opinion but its own, now finds itself preaching the same dogma of what is not really science but scientism. And so scientism is like
right.
any other ism, is just trying to make sure that people only have our point of view, and that's pretty much it. And it's
all
the
right.
same
yeah,
with it.
Yeah, we're... You're, yeah.
No, please.
We're
go.
Losing you. Yeah, we're
okay.
losing your sound quite a bit today. I don't know whether sometimes we, as speakers, move our heads around or something like that, and then we don't get a perfectly good connection. So I was
losing
you in and out.
I'll try and remain as still and as unanimated as what I can. But I didn't think that I was. Is that a little better?
No, it's terrible.
Oh, okay.
But maybe let Louise tell us if she's hearing okay. If that's good, then I'm not concerned.
Okay. Well, if others
anybody
are hearing,
there?
That's okay. But otherwise, I think, look, I could always ring back in again, I suppose. But let's
I know.
Just
you both, you can and I can. Okay.
Well, look,
Yes, so we can tell folks that they can go to that website. I think I closed it. Yeah, they can go to that website, and we'll give a link a little bit later and vote in the poll if they wish to. Maybe they should even write a blog about it. I think activism is really important. We've made big strides over the past couple of months by a lot of people voicing their opinions, and people do respond. Organizations do respond, and the Komen Foundation is one example.
Well, look, I think that it is important. I think the activism is important, and I think that the right to know shouldn't extend just to the skeptics and their opinion. So another person's opinion, in this case mine, of the skeptics itself, is that they are so full of loopholes, contradictions, and downright lies that it's just not funny. This whole idea of freedom of thought while trying to limit it, and it is a bullying tactic to make people feel so embarrassed and so stilly to even approach or ask the question of what is life, or does alternative medicine work? Should I see somebody about bigger questions? You know, they make them feel stupid for even asking them. So what the majority of people do, of course, is that they try to be rational and show, and the way that they show that their rational thought is by agreeing with the skeptics and now becoming skeptics themselves. So it's kind of like run with the pack, I suppose. And rather than in developing human thought, I mean, the skeptics would have, they don't at all. I mean, it limits thought entirely. It's this whole idea that if it can't be scientifically proved, that is quantified in a scientific way of touched and smelt and seen and all this sort of stuff, then it doesn't exist. But, I mean, that sort of negates nearly every thought process and every human emotion, let alone the bigger issues. So, I mean, this whole idea, the only thing, and it's also, too, this hiding behind the skirts of the double-blind trial, as if the double-blind trial is in some way going to eliminate bias, when, in fact, the real bias is always between the ears of the reader. It's never to do with the report itself. And people like Jacques Benavis is a perfect example of that, where he was able to, in his own mind, prove that there is kind of some sort of activity in what we would call the infinitesimal dose, and yet no one would accept those findings. So whether you do double blinds or you don't do double blinds is completely irrelevant, because you can't change the minds already set. But what I do is that I really take offence to the idea that they are going to purport lies as truth and then turn around and put themselves up, I guess, like the old medieval church did, put themselves up as the only bastion of knowledge and then tell lies to justify what is supposedly the truth that they are, and knocking everybody else's liars when they're doing exactly the same thing. When they turn around and say there's no scientific evidence for homeopathy, all you have to do is jump on the internet. You don't even have to go onto Google Scholar to find it. It's all over the place. But what they understand, of course, is that the vast majority of people will not look that up. So they're going to take them at their word because of generally the prestige that they have from the positions they hold. And I think it's a terrible abuse of power.
Okay, so is there a segue somehow from that thought to the fact that we are practicing homeopathy as unprejudiced observers as really a scientific method?
Well, look, I guess a segue? No, probably not. So we'll just
Moving you into the topic of the evening.
Yes, I fully understand that part, but I don't know what bridge we're going to take to get there, so let's just hop over.
We can jump over the bridge.
Yeah, that's right. The unprejudiced observer, I guess, look, I guess the only segue, as you talk about, is would really be that the acceptance of what we see, what can be repeatedly experienced and seen is what the truth is. I mean, essentially, science doesn't create anything. It simply stumbles across and tries to understand what already exists. It's not like physicists are making up the rules that govern particles or any other form of energy. They're simply trying to uncover and understand it. It's a little bit like Columbus discovering America, as if, you know, it's not as if he made it. It was already there. So, I mean, and homeopathy is exactly the same way. That's what science is. It's about trying to understand natural processes and then coming up with reproducible methods to be able to utilize it. Now, that methodology, or at least that attempt at reproducible methodology, is what is what homeopathy in itself is trying to achieve. There are, of course, a number of ways in which we can try to achieve this, and this is where homeopathy, I guess, begins to splinter and fragment a little bit. One of the things that I understand about going to India, whereas India is very much part of homeopathy, is the medical system. It is a medical science and a real science, and they protect that science of homeopathy. So the idea of let's talk about your favorite color, or let's give black can because my patient likes dogs, that just simply would not be in India. That would be mysticism gone mad. And so there is a number of different ways that practitioners claim that they can get homeopathy to reproducibly work. So what that says, I guess, is that the spectrum of homeopathy and at least how it can be used is fairly broad. But at the same time, we're not talking about the prestige of one person. And I guess this kind of ties in a little bit with what I was talking about last time, when it was I and a number of others were trying these more speculative methods, but finding that our results were not as good as if we just stuck by the classical rules. That doesn't mean that people who have mastered these speculative methods are not achieving those results. The question becomes, how reproducible is the system to it so that others can achieve those same results? Now, Hahnemann, if we're going to look at his writings regarding homeopathy, and we know that the doctrine of signatures and the speculative methods were around long before Hahnemann. And this is why in the introduction of the Organon, not only the 6th edition, but in the editions from about 1-6, talk about consistently that you should not be making these speculations. Now, he knows about it, which is kind of, so he, in some ways, there is a, you know, I don't want to get down this really kind of banal debate of is it an art or science, but in some way, because it is both. I mean, dealing with human beings is both. And but when you get too much into the speculation, this is where we have a tendency to let our own imaginations run free. And Hahnemann's saying, look, you know, not in exactly these words, but if you want to let your imagination run free, that's fine. But the clinic is not the place to do it. The clinic is the place to understand a particular methodology. The art is only in the eliciting of the case-taking. The art is getting the patient to tell you the information that you need. But the type of information that you need is very sequential. And that is the key to being able to understand this. It's got nothing to do with giving the potentized colour of the sweater that your patient just happens to be wearing while they're doing the consultation. That kind of mixing and matching is just simply not on. And I also don't agree with the idea that people can talk about their patient's favourite colour and with an hour and a half understand everything about them to a greater degree than what the patient understands themselves. I find that conceit is beyond the pale. And that is exactly what Hahnemann is saying not to do throughout the introductions. And this is why he talks about the unprejudiced observer. Don't throw any of your own opinions into what the patient is trying to say. So when we do our courses, either the live or the recorded, then one of the things that is emphasized continuously is the fact that you need to have a few hats on. It's sitting in front of you on your desk, not literal, of course, but you need to have a few hats sitting at your consultation table, and you put each one on as the time arises. When you are there to take the case, to be the unprejudiced observer, you leave your materia medica hat, you leave your psychology hat if you even have one, and you leave your repertorization hat on the table. All that you are doing at this stage is taking the case and only taking the case. Don't think about remedies, don't think about rubrics, and certainly don't think about potency. These are all issues that will flow in their own time. So all we are looking for when we take the case is to be as unprejudiced as possible. I don't see homeopathy as just medicine. I don't see it, certainly, it's more than that, and the mentals tell us this and so on. But I don't see it as psychological medicine either. That's just selling it short. What I see homeopathy as is homeopathy is this link between the physical and the energetic, the spiritual and the corporeal. And so what I'm looking for is that I'm looking for any form of energetic change that has a physical repercussion. Now, in order for me to get to the bottom of this, I first have to be unprejudiced. Now, to be totally unprejudiced in a homeopathic sense means that I have to adopt the idea that this drain in energy or this change in energy for the negative can come from any source. It does not have to be emotional. The person does not have to think badly of themselves or have an aberrant thought process. It can come from a variety of sources. It can just simply be overwork. They could drink too much alcohol than their constitution can stand. It can be that they are healthy in nearly every way, including their relationship, but the 20 cigarettes that they're smoking every day is destroying their vascular system. It doesn't have to go beyond that. We don't have to sort of immediately make the choice that this person must have a self-destructive tendency to even want to smoke. So what is that self-destruction? Why do they hate themselves? Let's go into that. This is where you're already becoming prejudiced. Because it could see an addiction can be an addiction. It doesn't have to be an obliteration unless you are seeing signs of total kind of personality obliteration taking form all across the board. But if somebody is having good relationships with others and they're stable in their family and work life, except that they smoke, that does not necessarily mean that the person is trying to obliterate self. That's taking it too far. And to take it from that position means that you're already prejudiced, because you're prejudiced in the fact that that's why people would do it. Whereas
can I jump in?
Of course.
Can I jump? Yeah, let me jump in there with that one statement. If the person does smoke and they smoke like a mad hatter and they say things to not just insinuate but to say that they hate themselves, then is it a fact? Is it objective? Or, you know, can you go in that direction? Or if they just say, I just love to smoke, it just feels so good. Then you cannot make the assumption that that is an act of destruction.
Yes, that's right. If they're turning around and they say to you, if I say to them, say, look, you know darn well that you're coming to me with vascular complaints, you're coming to me with ocular and vision problems, all part of the vascular system, and you're saying that you smoke a packet or more cigarettes a day, you know I'm going to tell you that, you know, you really do have to give up. Whether you do or not, that's up to you. But you know that it's my responsibility to tell you this, right? I mean, that's how I would approach it with a patient. And look, if the patient turns around and goes, I know, I've been thinking about it for years and I keep saying to myself, I will, but you know what? It's one of the most pleasurable times of my day. Then that's different to someone saying, I don't care if I live or die. Now, that, of course, opens up a huge array of questioning. But they have told you this. You haven't made that leap. That's the difference. So when we're talking about the mentals, or we're talking about any kind of searching a little deeper, it depends on whether or not the opening comes from the patient themselves. That's what the unprejudice is. To take
but
that
you, but
automatic
you can,
assumption.
You can use that, I'm sorry. You can use the fact that they smoke as a jumping off point to understand what they're doing in their life and how they started to do it and what it means to them.
Yes, you can do that. And look, if they turn around and they do it like most people who had smoked at some stage in their life or whatever, if they turn around and they say, look, I know it's a stupid habit, but you know, I was 15 and everyone at school was doing it, and, you know, so I just did it. I mean, to me, that's not a big deal, and I don't see any signs of self-obliteration in that. And obviously, they have real problems with the addiction, but and that's something that I would like them, with the help of homeopathy, to try and overcome. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they are deeply psychologically distraught. And so to draw those sort of inferences from habits, that's what I'm talking about. And of course, what Hahnemann is saying is if you just take things at face value, then you're going to find your remedy anyway. So you can end up spending the next hour and a half trying to delve into this person who has no idea how to answer you most of the time. So it's got to be pretty skilled. Otherwise, I mean, I remember hearing about a person who kind of proudly boasted one time that their consultation went for 6 or 7 hours, but they felt as if they really got it at the end. If you're taking 6 or 7 hours to get there, then really you're not asking the right questions.
Then they need to take your class.
you certainly do, because you are wasting a lot of time here. You don't know, if you're taking 7 hours before you come up with a rubric, you don't know what you're doing. There's nothing to be proud of in that. You're lost. Because in the end, I can just take 2 rubrics from this make-believe patient that we've got in front of us. I can take the disturbances of the vascular system, problems with the blood and veins, and I can also take in the rubric of the desires tobacco, and that sums up completely what that person is doing. So what we have is that in those 2 rubrics, we have the cause of the problem, the tobacco, and we have the outcome of the addiction, the vascular complaints. Now, whether or not I've got to the heart of the psychological cause of it is absolutely irrelevant, because in the end, that is what the person is coming for me to treat them with. And this is written all the way through the aphorisms, this inference. And this inference is this, that if you can take away the sum total of the physical perceivable signs and symptoms, then you must theoretically be getting at the heart of the emotional cause anyway. That's the problem. You see, this idea that we need to go deeper, 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 if I give this patient a remedy based on the 2 signs and symptoms that we just mentioned, plus a few other generals, and they come back and they say, you know, my circulation is much, much better, and I can breathe a little easier. And you know what? I have stopped. I have not had a cigarette since seeing you last. I just thought, you know, for some reason, I just got a little bit of willpower, and I thought that's fine. What Hahnemann is saying in his aphorism is that if the sum total of the signs and symptoms that the patient presents with you, the observable signs and symptoms, are eradicated or ameliorated, then whatever unknown, unperceived psychology that may be driving it must, by definition, also be quelled by the remedy as well. And that's why you need to forget about this delving and deeping and perhaps and surmising, and just take what is, because the remedy will treat that underlying causation. It has to, if it's the cause of the presenting signs and symptoms, and the remedy has taken away the signs and symptoms and the patient's feeling in good health.
Okay, so we need to learn how to take the case as an unprejudiced observer. And at the beginning, you said you have to not think about one thing or another, about remedies, about rubrics. And my question is how to do that. When I've spoken with Christina Chambrow, she says, oh, this came up in your mind, write it down and put it on the side. Is that something that you do?
No, I would say the opposite to that. I would say that nothing much should be coming into your mind except following on from what that person is saying. Maybe I just have a gift for having a brain with nothing in it.
I was going to say this isn't the art of Zen homeopathy. Keep your mind flat.
I mean, we've all got some certain talents, and I've got perhaps my talent is to have an empty mind. So. But essentially, that's what I'm doing. I'm sitting there and I am taking in what that person is saying. It's not entirely true that I'm not thinking about anything. But what I am thinking of is, how do I link what you've just said now to what you've said in the past? Is there a link, or have I heard this before? So when, like, let's just stick with vascular complaints, right? So if a person comes in and they say, look, you know, there's real problems with my vision, and I've been diagnosed with glaucoma. Also, too, I'm finding that I've got a lot of varicose veins, and also, too, my kidney function is down considerably. The thing that links them all is the vascular system. And so all of a sudden what I've got is that I've got myself a general. And that's essentially what it is. It's this, and you can do exactly the same with mentals, which I'll discuss next week. But all you're trying to do with life themes is create a general, in just the same way as what I've just done there. So when I say that, look, I'm not really thinking, that's not entirely true. When I put my case taking hat on, it's essentially doing two things. One is that it's asking questions to elicit more information. The second thing that I'm doing is that I'm trying to link those bits of information into an overall picture. And so, like I said, if someone's talking about lowered kidney function, if they're talking about glaucoma, they're talking about varicose veins, or they're talking about numbness of their hands and fingers, then I would be linking that and saying, okay, well, what is the general? And the general is just simply what is the overall cause most likely going to be. So instead of putting in glaucoma, instead of putting in Raynaud's disease, instead of putting in kidney function and varicose veins as four separate rubrics, I would link that all together and I would put in the problems with the vascular system. Then I would just move on to the next rubric.
Okay. Was there something else that we should know about?
I think that's probably enough. And what I'll do is that I'll try and discuss some of that with the mentals and how you make these generals out of mentals.
Okay. So we're just about out of time. We're keeping it to the 30-minute time spot to this evening because that was the request from listeners. I do want to remind those who do listen into the show that they can come to the website. They can get an RSS feed. They can download it to their computer, to their iPod, to their iPad, to their cell phone. They can even embed the show onto their website and share with other people. Write a blog about it, talk about it, and definitely visit the www.vcch.org, the website for Grant, so that you can learn more specifically. All of the shows are linked up there, plus a lot more podcasts. You can learn about the upcoming classes coming, I think, March, and something might be happening this month also.
Yes, we've got, look, there's a number of, and also, too, with the recorded things, recorded classes, recorded cases, and so on. See, people can sign up for those at any time. They don't have to wait for a precise time. So they can sign up and begin learning this at their own pace at any stage.
Very good. Okay, whatever level you're at, there's something for you there. And I want to remind people that on Wednesday morning, it'll be 11 a.m. Eastern Time, USA, Dr. Adil Kasim will be talking about cardiology and your health, your heart health. And on Thursday at noon, we're going to move our regular scheduled show with Alan Phillips over to Friday at 2 p.m. And then I think we're going to also have Greg Glazer coming on with us, constitutional lawyer from California. And then at our regularly scheduled 1 p.m. time slot with Christina Chambreau, we're going to talk about animals that have post-traumatic stress syndrome from being in the military. That's going to be quite fascinating. And let your friends who love animals and pets listen in about, we will definitely talk about homeopathy in regard to that also. So I want to thank Grant for taking his time to be with us this evening. And what, it's are you at Tuesday in the morning right now?
Yeah, it's just past midday.
Midday, so you, it's lunchtime for you. Okay.
It's lunchtime for us.
Yeah, and I just finished dinner. So, okay, it's a wild world. Okay, so definitely if anybody has any questions, send them to us so we can address them on future shows. And we're going to be signing out this evening as soon as I find the music to send us off. And we will see you the next week, next Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Homeopathy and Spatial Analysis on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopaths Debbie Bruck and Grant Bentley. We encourage you to follow our show. Click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air. Share with friends on Facebook and MySpace and also Twitter. We welcome your comments and questions. See you next time.